Our gracious Father, we thank you so much that the words of your mouth are sweeter than honey and more precious than thousands of gold and silver pieces. And we pray very much that we would find that to be the case this morning, that by your Spirit you would open your word to us and speak to us, and that we would indeed find it to be sweet and precious. And we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Good. Well, our topic this morning is so big and so important, it has almost, I think, become a cliche. We're thinking this morning about the meaning of life. What is life all about? What are we here for? Is there a purpose to our being here? And if so, what is it? And if that sounds a little bit heavy for a Sunday morning, then I guess that if we're honest with ourselves, we would have to agree that it is probably the most significant question we will ever face. One of the saddest things you can ever think is that there is no purpose to your life. And one of the hardest things that you can ever hear is that you might be wasting your life. But if that's true, if we know that these sorts of things are important, it's striking, isn't it, just how little serious thought we often give to it. So easy just to drift through the various stages of life in a sort of spiritual daze. Going to school, getting a few qualifications, hopefully. Maybe a university or an apprenticeship somewhere, then a job, a relationship, property ladder, various crises in all of the above, middle age, retirement, and never really taking the time to think, what is it all about? But of course, you'll know some people who have given it quite a bit of thought and concluded that the search is ultimately futile. We're just wasting our time asking these sorts of things. There is no real meaning to life whatsoever. Richard Dawkins, the well-known atheist, speaks for many when he says, "The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference." Or others see the folly, really, of that kind of thinking, and they know that there must be some meaning to life, some purpose, some point to getting up in the morning. They just don't know what it is. And therefore, if I think that there must be some purpose to life, or there must be something that makes sense of it all, but I don't know what that is, then what I'm forced to do is to make one up for myself, which usually involves work, or money, or sex for the blokes, or relationships, holidays, and shopping for the ladies. So excuse my stereotyping, but I think it probably is true, isn't it? But that makes those first three verses from Genesis chapter 2 massively helpful and important for us. Because what they tell us is that when God made us and made his world, he had a particular plan in mind. He made us for a reason. He made us for a purpose. And it's a purpose that gives the life of each and every one of us meaning and significance. And it is a purpose that God himself rates so highly that he will see it through to its final completion. What is that purpose? What are we here for? And this brings me to my first of three points this morning. Because we see in these three verses from Genesis 2 that we were created to enjoy God's rest. We were created, we were made to enjoy God's rest. just glance down, if you've got the Bible open, just glance down to chapter 2, verse 1, where we're told that thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation. You can see straight away that the seventh day is really quite different from the first six. On those days, God has been working, creating the world, a world that he himself describes. Just look across to chapter 1, verse 31. God himself describes it as very good. But now, twice, the author tells us that by the seventh day he has finished that work, and twice we are told that God then rests. The seventh day is the day of God's rest. But notice that this rest has nothing to do with leisure or just lazing around with the feet up. It's not as if God is pretty frazzled by such a busy week. And he flops in the armchair and reaches for the remote. No, for God to rest means that God, together with the people he has made and the creatures he's made, is enjoying the fruits of his labor. And we can see that by the fact that unlike the first 6 days, did you notice, the seventh day is not said to end. So back in chapter 1, we won't turn back to it, but in chapter 1, verse 5, at the end of the verse, we're told there was evening and there was morning the first day, and then the second day, the third day, and so on. One day ends and the next day dawns. But the seventh day just carries on. No eighth day, no starting all over again, going to the first day. The seventh day just goes on. And the point is this: the seventh day is the goal or the climax or the purpose of days 1 to 6. God's work was to make a very good world, a paradise, and God's rest is to enjoy that world permanently with the people he has made. You could say that God's rest is enjoying his paradise. And that's why he blesses the seventh day. That's why he makes it holy or special. It belongs specially to him, for him to use, to enjoy, and to share. And the author's telling us all of this so that we will see that is why you were made. To belong to God and enjoy his rest in a perfect relationship with him, with other people, in his world. Now that's quite a challenge for us to take on board, isn't it, really? Because it means that there are loads of things in life that we might think that life is all about, but actually life is not about those things. So for instance, it means that life is not about going to work. We might laugh because that sounds so obvious or such a relief, but probably most of us have been brought up to think that the ultimate goal in life is to get a successful job of some kind with a steady salary, a nice detached house. That's what our parents probably hoped for us. That's what our own hearts wanted for us. And that's what most of the decisions of probably the first 20 or so years of our lives revolved around. And God says to us, if that is what you've been told, that life is all about going to work and earning and so on and so forth, he says, I'm afraid you've been sold a lie. That is not what life is mainly all about. Life is not about finding the right partner. I guess that the film Bridget Jones is quite dated now, isn't it, really? but her take on life is really still pretty bang up to date. I'll feel complete and fulfilled and happy and special when I've met the right person. That's when life will be better. It might take me a few goes, but I'll get there in the end. And again, God says to us, if that is what I've been told, that is what life is all about, the Holy Grail, then again, I have been sold a lie. Of course, relationships and marriage and so on are good gifts from God, but they are not what life is mainly about. And if we think they are, that's why we're so easily disappointed again and again. So it's a bit of a challenge for us, isn't it? But it's also, I hope, a comfort. Because some of us have probably just finished term at school, or we've got kids who have, and we know that our friends are already having a better summer than we are. Possibly. They're off on more exotic holidays where the sun shines fairly regularly. Their exam results will send them further than ours will send us. And some of us might bump into an old friend this week, maybe moving up the generations. Some of us will bump into an old friend this week, maybe while they're pushing the buggy down the roads. And as you get into a chat, their marriage will seem a bit more exciting than yours, possibly. Possibly. Their kids will seem a little bit better behaved than yours, possibly. Their home life is just a little bit easier than yours. Others of us might be at that stage of life when we're looking back over what might have been. And the truth is that other people have made a slightly better fist of life than perhaps we have. Made better decisions, enjoyed better breaks, just done a bit better in most areas, really. And God says to each and every one of us this morning, take heart, because life is not about any of those things. The point of life, the purpose of life, is to enjoy God's rest. But you can see the problem. Where is this paradise rest? Where has it gone? Because we haven't got it now. And you'll probably know that in Genesis chapter 3, Adam and Eve disobey God. That is the big disaster. And from that moment on, the very good world of Genesis 1 and 2, the very good world of God's rest, is no more. It vanishes. God drives them out of the Garden of Eden. There's this flaming sword that guards the way back to the Tree of Life. And instead of life and peace and rest, there is death and condemnation and judgment. And basically, the rest of the Bible is all about how God brings people back and puts things right, so that once again we can enjoy that perfect rest for which we were made. And what we see in the Old Testament as we move through several thousand years, very briefly, is that, and this is the second of the 3 points, is that Israel, the nation of Israel in the Old Testament, Israel was rescued to enjoy God's rest. So all people were created to enjoy God's rest in the beginning. And then further on in the Bible, Israel was rescued to enjoy God's rest. And you may know that in Genesis chapter 12, no need to turn on, but in Genesis 12, God makes promises to a man called Abraham. And he promises him a land and a big family or a great nation and rich blessings. We haven't time to look at them all now, but you could summarize what God promises Abraham as rest. And 400 or so years later, God rescues Abraham's descendants, the nation of Israel, from being slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. He does that through Moses. You've probably seen the film, even if you haven't read the book, although the book, as ever, is much better.
And the reason he rescues them is that they can enjoy his rest.
Leads them through the wilderness and brings them into the land of Canaan. And Canaan is a land of rest. So let me read from the book of Joshua, chapter 21. Again, no need to turn to this, but the book of Joshua, chapter 21. Listen to these two verses. Thus the Lord gave to Israel all the land that he swore to give to their fathers. They took possession of it and they settled there. And the Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their fathers. Not one of all their enemies had withstood them, for the Lord had given all their enemies into their hands. And so you can see from just those two verses that a big part of what it means to have rest is to have peace from enemies. And this hits at the high point a few hundred years later under King Solomon. King Solomon himself says, as he's about to build the temple, he says, "Now the Lord my God has given me rest on every side. There is neither adversary nor misfortune." And this tells us a bit more about what God's rest is like. God's rest includes peace. There are no adversaries or enemies. It includes prosperity. There are no disasters. And then best of all, King David, who came a bit before Solomon, said about his reign, "The Lord, the God of Israel, has given rest to his people, and he dwells in Jerusalem forever." That is, the best thing about God's rest is not the peace, although that's really good. It's not the prosperity, although that's worth having. It is the fact that God is present alongside them. But again, and you may know this, that the big problem with this mini paradise rest in Canaan is that Israel loses it. Adam and Eve rebelled against God and got kicked out of the Garden of Eden. The people of Israel rebel against God and get kicked out of the land of Canaan. Paradise lost again. And before we move on, two brief lessons for us to learn from what happened to the people of Israel. And the first is that God's rest was wonderful to experience. If we're not convinced of that from Genesis chapter 2, we should be convinced of it from Israel. Because under King Solomon especially, Israel's quality of life is the envy of the whole world. At one point, the Queen of Sheba pops over for a visit, and she is gobsmacked by how dazzling it all is. Israel really does enjoy the good life. And all of us want peace, don't we? For the people of God back then, it was the threats, peace from the threats from the Philistines or the Amalekites. In the 21st century AD, there is the ideological struggle with Islam in our schools and cities and with secular humanism in our media and governments. And in every century, it is ultimately the powers of sin and Satan himself we need peace from. And even the staunch atheists, I'm sure, sees the photos of the bomb blasts in Gaza and he agrees that peace is a very attractive thing indeed. And all of us want prosperity, I'm guessing. Back then, for the people of God, there was the danger of your cattle could get disease, or your harvest might fail, and so on. Nowadays, I guess it might be unemployment or failed investments. Savings gone down the tube. And in every century, of course, it's ultimately the powers of death and decay we need rescue from. And even the staunch atheist, I guess, will look at the recession of the last few years, and he will agree that prosperity is something very attractive indeed. And then best of all, there is the presence of God. What a tremendous thing to have with you the one around whom the whole universe revolves. The one who gave you life and gives meaning to that life. the one who is the source of everything that is good in the world. What a tremendous thing, not only to belong to him, but to have him living openly just doors down the street, as it were. So God's rest was wonderful for them to experience. Particularly, it was impossible for them to keep. It was impossible for Israel to keep. Because to keep hold of God's rest, Israel had to keep God's commands. And just like Adam and Eve before them, Israel found that to be an impossible task. Sure, they had some good moments, but mainly they just crashed and burned time and again, turned away from God, turned to worship other gods and bow down to them instead. And from their experience, we have to learn this lesson. We cannot get back to God's rest by our own achievements. Whether it's the scientist with her discoveries, or the engineer with his inventions, or the Muslim with his five pillars, or the Christian feeling pleased with himself because he had his quiet time this morning. If I think I can get back to God's paradise by the things that I do, then the Bible will always blow a very loud raspberry in my face. Adam and Eve couldn't do it. Israel couldn't do it. The only way any of us can get back to God's rest is if God himself does something. Or to be more precise, if God himself sends someone. And of course, that someone is Jesus. And that brings us to the last of our points this morning. If we were created to enjoy God's rest, if Israel were rescued to enjoy God's rest, thirdly and lastly, Jesus has come to give us God's rest. Let me read some famous words that Jesus says in Matthew chapter 11, verse 28. He says to me, "Come." He says to us, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." I guess those words are familiar to many of us. We often or sometimes say them at a communion service, like this one this morning. But because they're so familiar, it is easy, I think, to miss the magnitude, the importance, the sheer wonder of what Jesus is saying to us. He is talking to a crowd weighed down and burdened by a religion that insists on rigorous observance of every rule and regulation. A religion that means every slip up makes the incline just a little bit steeper every time. And he says, come to me, and I will give you rest. He's looking ahead to his death on the cross, and he says, come to me, and I will do away with the problem of God's righteous anger that is hanging over your heads. He says, come to me, and I'll restore you to that perfect relationship with God for which you were made. Come to me, and on the day that you die, I will take you to be with me in paradise. And at the end of the age, I will take you, he says, to a world that is even better than the one that Adam and Eve threw away. They are wonderful words of Jesus, aren't they? He has come to give us back God's rest. And it's important to say at this point, I think, that he does that largely in the world to come, in the new creation, rather than now. There are fabulous blessings of belonging to Jesus. But most of them, especially the things we've been thinking about, like peace and prosperity, they are for the world to come, more so than for this world. But if Jesus has come to give us God's rest, to reconcile us to God, to bring us back to him, let me close with three brief implications for us.
And the first one is the generosity of Jesus. The generosity of Jesus. All of us will have friends and family, I guess, striving after their own personal paradise. Sadly, it is futile to do because it's never attainable. And it is usually painful to watch, isn't it? Because they always have to sacrifice years of their lives, thousands of their pounds, the welfare of their families, and so on. But maybe it is the Muslim friend who will spend his whole life striving to satisfy Allah, hoping that on the judgment day he'll have done enough. Maybe it's your sister who changes the color of her hair and nails on a weekly basis, hours down the salon, retail therapy every Saturday, in the hope of reaching the paradise of being popular. Maybe the retired couple down the road, for whom life is basically the garden, the golf club, and the grandchildren. And Jesus says, look, not only is that a poor and pale shadow of God's paradise rest, but while you're striving and straining after what is really a cheap fake, Jesus says, I'm giving away the real thing for free to anyone who will come to him. What a tremendously generous thing that is. First, the generosity then of Jesus. Secondly, the contentedness of Christians. If Jesus has come to give us rest, that should make us very content with our lot. Let me give you an example. To become a Church of England minister, you have to go on and pass a selection conference, which somehow I managed. And one of my friends was on one of these conferences, and they ask you, as you can imagine, these various questions about this and that. And at one point, my friend was asked, would you consider your life to be a success? Would you consider your life to be a success? And he said, very gently, yes, I would. Yes, I would. Now, in many ways, this friend of mine is a pretty impressive sort of person. He's very bright, got a PhD in maths from Oxford, very athletic, though probably not quite as streamlined as he used to be. He has a lovely wife with three kids. But the reason he said yes wasn't to do with any of those things. The reason he said yes was simply because he is someone who has come to Jesus. And Jesus has given him rest. And he knew that that means that his life must be a success, mustn't it? If the purpose of life is to receive God's rest from Jesus, then if I've done that, then my life must be a success. I might not have won as many medals as Usain Bolt. You might not look like Brad Pitt or Scarlett Johansson. You might never have achieved anything more impressive in life than a 10-meter swimming certificate. But if the purpose of life is to enjoy God's rest, and if I've come to Jesus and been given that rest, it must mean my life is a success, mustn't it? The generosity of Jesus, the contentedness of Christians, and thirdly and lastly, the priority of persevering. That is to say, if Jesus has done it all for us in his life and death and resurrection, if we don't have to earn God's rest, we just receive it from him, from Jesus, how important it is to keep holding on to Jesus. We keep hold of God's rest by keeping hold of Jesus, trusting in him and him alone now and always. That must be the priority for us, mustn't it, if we are followers of Jesus. And so as we finish, what is the purpose of life? Is there a point to it all? Well, yes, there is. Whatever the atheist and the agnostic might say, you are not a completely futile being. You are not a complete waste of time. You were made for a purpose, to know God and enjoy him with him in his paradise rest. And if you've come to Jesus, or if you will come to Jesus today, you can be sure that he will give you that rest.